especially with the data that we see with the 180-pound DB having Achilles tendons as big as offense and defensive linemen, that they probably use their tendons to move more. Whereas the muscle-driven guy uses his muscle to move more. And so if I'm using my tendons to move more, I should definitely be supplementing with collagen.
That was Ryan Jackson, and you're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Plyomat. The Plyomat is not only an incredible vertical jump and reactive strength index testing device, but it also is an incredible training device. The Plyomat not only allows single response jumps, but also the chaining of multiple mats together. So you can use it for bounding multiple series of hurdle hops. And you can get not only height, but reactive strength for a multi-jump situation. It's an incredible, again, testing and training tool. And you can learn more at plyomat.net. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm excited to have Ryan Jackson as this week's guest. And Ryan is the Associate Director of Human Performance and Nutrition with Texas Christian Football. Ryan has over 15 years of experience working in the NCAA Division I in sports performance and nutrition. Right now, his dual role with Texas Christian involves team nutrition education and menu planning. And then on the sports performance side, he works directly with quarterbacks, mids, and advanced athletes. Tendon training is a really important and rapidly evolving topic in the athletic performance world. Ryan and the staff at Texas Christian have found interesting correlations between Achilles tendon thickness, something associated with elasticity and power production. So correlations between that tendon thickness and key athlete or athletic performance metrics. So we'll be talking about those correlations on the show today, as well as some of the adaptations of the tendon that Ryan saw throughout the training year, and as well as the differences in Achilles tendon thickness between positions and directional demands on the field. He'll also be getting into the infrasternal angle and some correlations seen there. So we'll be covering both the tendon and bone structure piece. And this was just a really fun and informational show. It was great talking with Ryan, and I know you guys will enjoy this one. Let's get to episode 402 here with Ryan Jackson. Ryan, welcome to the show. It's awesome to have you here. I know we're going to have a great conversation today.
Man, I'm fired up to be here. Longtime listener and just a huge fan of your work, your articles, and your book. So I'm excited to chat.
Yeah. So what, I know we'll be talking a lot about like tendons and elasticity topics. I always enjoy this stuff. What got you interested in like the tendon and elastic piece in the first place? Because I know you're doing a crazy amount of work now on it. But what was that time point where you started to get more into the tendon piece of things and elasticity piece?
Yeah, I think it was, I was at a CPSDA conference, which is like the Collegiate and Professional Sports Dietitians Association, because I do both, actually. I'm a registered dietitian and strength conditioning coach. And it was Keith Barr's presentation. And then, you know, I watched, you know, from his first paper to where he's at now, I saw the information evolve, and it just kind of drove me to learn more and understand more about the tendons. And I did a deep dive, which we can put in the show notes. And now my opinions have evolved because this was almost 5 or 6 years ago. I did Dr. Ben House's Bro Research content creation course. And that's the topic I chose, was how do tendons adapt? And what I found is that the research is pretty lacking in terms of measuring tendon adaptation. Some of that's rightfully so. It's a little bit more difficult tissue to measure, which we can get into. Also, when we're, you know, looking at the tendon measurements that we did, and how they change slowly, but they also change acutely in terms of size as well. So, but yeah, it's an area that is definitely under research, and more so it's like completely under researched in high level athletes.
Yeah, I love that. I know with tendons too, it is interesting. You think about just how much research has gone into muscles and muscle physiology, and you mentioned your history in nutrition, and how much research has gone in nutrition as it, you know, is applied to muscle versus looking at the tendon. And it is, you know, the tendons, it is so interesting, even with Not just from like a database, but also like the visual quality. I know Jake Tura just posted like it was like a rat tendon and it was inactive for 20 days and then loaded for 20 days. And the inactive, you don't know necessarily what the exact lines mean, but you can just tell the unloaded was just all messed up and it just didn't look right. And it reminded me a little bit of my, I had a daughter born about 2 months ago. And after she was born, I didn't train at all for 2 weeks. And my right Achilles just swelled up. And I was like, it's just so funny because you would think it's the other way. If you don't do anything, you have like a muscle, muscle damage. And anyways, I'm glad we're learning more about tendons and tendon physiology. And I just think there is so much there. And including too, like, watching like animals that have very little, like on the lower legs, very little muscle mass, but there's so much going on from that connective tissue, bones. I think we'll be getting into bones a little bit too today and things like that. Yeah. And I know skeletal alignment. So, the first question I have then with like actual as related to training is what are some of the, like what's with the Achilles specifically? Cause I know you've done a lot of work with the Achilles tendon, like the biggest tendon of the body. So it's probably, a good place to start, but, I know you've done a little bit of research and work into the Achilles as it relates to different performance indicators. Maybe let's start with that because I think that'll also probably pique people's interest as well as mine when you message me about it.
Yeah. So to give some people some background, the TCU Kinesiology Department is going to be publishing a study that we did across an entire football year, where we measured. We can get into some of the limitations of the study, but we initially measured about 33 athletes. Ended up with about 20 that made it through the whole deal. And we measure them across four times in the year, postseason, post spring ball, post summer, and then post season. And in those measurements, we did a DEXA, to measure bone and then body comp. From that is arguably one of the most accurate ways to measure the ISA. Because it's an actual x-ray. And in that as well, we measured Achilles tendon thickness at the malleolus to see really how all those changed throughout the year. And so if we want to jump into the Achilles tendon stuff, right?
Yeah, and then we can go to the ISA or some of the other things afterwards.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, like I said, measurement was at the malleolus. You use ultrasound, and you're able to get, a centimeter measurement of the Achilles tendon, cross-sectional area or thickness. So what we saw is that Achilles tendon thickness did increase from our first measurement. Every single measurement increased across the year. From a statistical standpoint, it was not significant. But one of the limitations in tendon measurement is that acutely, it's going to decrease in response to training for up to 4 days. And we're talking about working in college football. I would be lying to everyone if I told you that we didn't do measurements directly after training. With class schedules and all that, there's only so many times that we could do that. And there's really not that much off time to like line up all those measurements after full rest. So you could make the hypothesis that change was potentially more significant, just based on when guys got measured. And like a lot of times it was like train that day and then a couple hours later they got measured. So tendon size, yeah, we touched on the acute versus chronic change. From positional differences, the skill athletes went from, on average were about 0.461 plus or minus 0.05 centimeters. Mids were 0.492 plus or minus 0.03 centimeters, and the bigs were 0.533 plus or minus 0.04 centimeters. Now, the cool thing is we had some outliers and what I would say in some ways are anomalies. Our second biggest Achilles tendon on the team was a 180-pound defensive back. And the only guy that had a bigger Achilles tendon than him is like a 275-pound, 8% fat, freak of nature defensive lineman. You know, and then in that upper 25% quartile was two skill, one mid, and six bigs.
Yeah. So based on that, I would be really curious too. You mentioned the outliers, and I enjoy digging into outliers because I think, you know, just like the regular norms of the bell curve, I think there's a lot to learn by looking at some of those people who are outside of it. And I mean, is someone like that D back, I mean, was he in terms of like his outputs, like reactive ability would probably come to mind, like top end speed or those types of things. But was there was anything that, and it makes me think as well about like a Stephon Holm, where I don't know what his Achilles tendon thickness was, but I remember hearing that. So Stephon Holm, for people who don't know, high jumper, jumped almost 2 feet over his own head. And you know, the Holm hurdles, famous for Holm hurdles and things. And they said that his Achilles, I think, took four times the pressure to depress or something like that than an average person. But it was interesting because his standing vertical was really, really bad. And I mean, part of it might have been just practice and like emphasis on it, you know, being a high jumper, maybe just don't care about it. Maybe if he didn't play, you know, double leg jumping sports that much, maybe, you know, but I'd be curious what you might see in someone who has a really well-developed, or your just your thoughts on someone who's really well-developed from that perspective. Because to me, that it does seem like that would almost go one-to-one in many ways with just plyometric ability from, you know, from a very general perspective. So curious what your thoughts are with that.
Yeah, I know we didn't, part of this was getting this study up and running.
Yeah.
And keeping the main thing, so. There's some things that we can talk about a little bit later, that we started to explore our GPS reports, and we did start to find some interesting correlations there. But I don't think that we know enough at this point to like truly say, because, you know, Jake Turo would have to correct me on this because I get it backwards sometimes, but I don't think that we can say big equals good. You know, and I do think that, yeah, bigger tendons are probably more susceptible to tendinopathies. So yeah, with that, but I do think it has, you know, it's a factor in how they play their position, not necessarily what position they play. Having said that, I do have a good question for you and the listeners to think about. If you take quarterbacks out, and we didn't measure specialists, which group do you think on average, which position group on average had the smallest tendons? And I'm not talking skill, mids, and bigs. I'm talking specific position.
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know. I mean, on one end, you know, you'd say maybe like a kicker or something, but they have to plant like that. I've seen kickers and high jump be actually like a correlation kind of, but I guess it depends on your athletic background. Yeah.
So, but we didn't measure specialists and kickers.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
take quarterbacks out, take specialists out. What position group do you think it is?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't know. Maybe like running back and or someone who just has to go forward but stays low to the ground. Maybe that's
all. You're getting warmer.
Okay, I wasn't totally off. I don't know. You tell me. That was my best guess initially.
It was wide receiver.
Okay, interesting.
And I, you know. Dumb me thinks it's because they move forward, whereas DBs on average had bigger Achilles tendons.
Interesting.
You know, we actually a guy the second biggest, and I think it's a product of their movement and their position, where by backpedaling, moving backwards more, it's more, you know, eccentric loading.
I 100% see that, because when you're doing even just doing like just a track practice yesterday, I had a huge group and we're just doing both back pedaling and then backwards running with like a, you know, taking the heel up to the hip and then kicking back. And, you know, every time you do that, your foot is landing behind you on the ball of the foot. And the calf has to activate pretty hard because when you're like backpedaling fast, you don't want the heel to come down or you're going to blow up your Achilles. I mean, that's actually like an Achilles mechanism in like basketball is a lot of times you hit that drop to go by a defender or something. And there's situations where the heel could come down, but if it comes down in the wrong load, like you're in trouble. And so that makes sense that. And I always did, you know, it is funny because even in my head, as I'm working with track athletes, like jumpers and people who are reactive, I do watch like backwards running, not backpedaling, but when you have you're lifting your hip up or heel up to the butt and kicking.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, because track, it's funny. I remember that's one of the first things, or not one of the first things, but from my memories of being coached in track, that was something that always stuck with me for whatever reason. Maybe just felt elastic. I don't know, you know, but then something I watched.
You do it right.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Pick heels up and get their heel to their butt and reach back. But yeah, if you do it right, I think it is a very elastic movement.
Yeah. It may, what you're saying reminds me of, it was an old like Dan Paff lecture. I mean, this might have been like almost 20 years ago at this point. He was talking about like hamstring injuries. And I think it was like D-backs or people that go backwards a lot also have less hamstring incidents. In whatever, you know, population he was studying. So it's interesting to think about. I think with some of these things too, you might say like, like backwards walking, for example, people might just take backwards, going backwards and peg it to one thing only. There might be the habit of that. Like, oh, walk backwards for your quads or run backwards for your Achilles or your hamstring. But it's like just multilateral movement is a high level of complexity, I think, offers a lot of things that we can grow and look at. So, you know, I'm thankful for those anecdotes from Dan, and then yourself there. It gives me a lot to think about with how that all factors in.
And so we did measure some performance indicators. And so one of the things we did find correlated with Achilles, and, you know, I had the research team explain this to me, the old R value in research. And you know, he dumbed it down to me like I was a 5-year-old. So
that was my stats class when I was in. That was my stats class experience when I was in grad school. So you're not alone there.
So average force and maximal force on a Nordic was significantly correlated with Achilles tendon thickness, and the actual number is 91%. And so, in layman's term, what that means is 90% of the force produced in a Nordic can be explained by Achilles tendon thickness.
That's really
so typically significant is anything greater than 0.5 or 50%. And that was probably the highest correlation we found, which was, you know, 9-1. And then probably second biggest was Achilles tendon thickness is correlated to lean mass at a 0.82. So
that's 82%. Yeah. One thing I did want to mention before we got into that was you had mentioned thickness might not be purely one-to-one. I was thinking about like the different parts of the Achilles, right? Like you have the matrix, like the collagen matrix. I'm like waving my fingers around like a matrix here. And then you have like the actual thick, you know, tendon, like aligned tendon parts. So I wonder, even like right now, like I mentioned, my right Achilles got a little inflamed or very inflamed after I didn't do anything after my daughter was born. And it's like, yeah, that tendon would probably measure thicker. You know, you wonder like if there's little nuances, right? Like if it versus like a Stefan Holm, like strain value, like how much strain can this handle? What's the tensile quality? But I'm sure there's a lot of correlation. I'm sure there's much, much more overlap than there is.
And there is some new stuff. I think we're going to try out because this is going to be a ever building study. IRB is approved to continue doing this. I guess there is ways of measuring stiffness now with ultrasound. Don't ask me to tell you how because I don't know, but I know that our researchers told us that. And then the other piece I think that you're getting to, and I think about this a lot with Keith Barr's stuff, is like the where you measure the tendon. Ours is at the malleolus, but in theory, the closer you get to bone, the more stiff the tendon is.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the closer you get to the muscle, the more, you know, contractile properties, if you will.
Interesting. Yeah.
So maybe another study will measure it at three different points.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I hear these, I just continually think about how awesome the body is, like how we try to pin it down. And then it's like, no, here's another layer of complexity you forgot about. Or, yeah, obviously, you know, but like you have to deal with, right? Like it reminds, even thinking about how like the psoas, the hip flexor muscle works, like part of it shortens or holds an isometric, the other part of it can lengthen. Like it's to me, it's just amazing how the body facilitates movement. With so the Nordic correlation is really interesting. And I will say, I've certainly had in my experience with track and field and sprinters and mid distance and Nordics, is some of the best Nordic hamstring folk I actually had were in the mid distance group. And I almost wonder if some of that is because maybe more ground contact, if there is that correlation, right? Like more ground contacts, maybe a strong Achilles to draw from. I mean, I had some sprinters who were pretty darn good at it too, without question, you know, but I had mid distance people that definitely surprised me. I was like, wow. Like, and you would think just from a pure strength or force perspective, oh, you should be in the sprints, but it's not one-to-one like that, you know? And I know even for myself, it is interesting. I remember when I was at Cal, the Nordboard team came in to do a demo, and so all the strength coaches did a demo on the Nordboard. And my, for someone who I have weak hamstrings in certain positions, I think I tend to be someone whose glutes and calves can kind of take over for certain things, and the hamstrings kind of hang out.
Oh, I'm the same way. If I do leg curls on a K box, like I'd like flex my calf.
Yeah. Like, yes. Same. Yeah. That's me 100%. So, but what was interesting is that Nordboard test, I got a really, really high score. I don't remember what it was, but it was like, it was way up there. And I think the other coaches were kind of like, I don't know if they were expecting that. Cause like I've had some okay weight room lifts, but I'm definitely not like a strength, like all-star. And yeah, that was like, you know, that was this, and but yet I tested extremely high on that. And I am also like super elastic. Like I am a foot and calf and lower leg and bounce driven person. And I'm sure my Achilles have some level of thickness to them. So it makes me wonder, even to like almost beyond a single muscle, like you think, oh, Nordics and hamstrings. I mean, there's a whole chain of muscles and a whole chain, you know, you have. And not that the fascia is like doing everything, but you have, you know, the fascial lines and you have like the connective tissue and all that. And so I'm sure my calves were absolutely like dominating that, you know, as much as they could, that Nordic. But yeah, I just found that interesting because I wasn't thinking of myself as someone who necessarily had strong hamstrings. I will say that just one other thing quickly is, yeah, they're definitely not in like deadlifting. They're not strong. It's like glutes, a little bit lower back. You know, like that's the main movers. I won't feel really sore in my hammies, but I remember I've gotten isokinetic tests on my hamstrings and they weren't bad. But then again, those isokinetic tests might have been a lot of calf too. You know, there's no, unless you tell me to point my toe down, like plantar flex, have me do it and put my toes in plantar flexion, it might be a drastically different result. But anyway, yeah. Long story short, I just thought that was interesting because like I said, I tested very high on those. Relative to some other things that, and I wasn't expecting it.
Yeah, the only other like big take home point with the Achilles tendon size was, yeah, the changes weren't significant, but the time period we saw the biggest change was from our first measurement, which this study we did the last year. So this past year, the year before, we played in the national championship game. And so the guys had like 2 weeks off after the national championship game, which we can open up a can of worms. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen how the new playoff looks. If you make it all that way, you're playing until like January 20th.
Wow. Yeah.
So, but anyways, so they had 2 weeks off and then we measured. And that was like a month and a half after the national championship game is when we finally started doing the measurements. And the original plan was to measure earlier, like right after postseason, but our season kept going, which is a good thing. Then the second measurement was post spring ball. So that's when we saw the greatest change. My hypothesis is that they had time off. We know the tendon likes to be loaded. so they weren't loading their tendons as much. And then they went through like, it was like, ended up being like 6 weeks of winter off season. And then they went into spring ball, and then we measured a post spring ball. So if you believe in the muscle driven versus elastic, then I think you had like a perfect blend of like more muscle driven work with off season training. And then you go to spring ball and you have more elastic work. So you can't 100% say what that change was accounted to. Like, was it because of spring ball? Was it because of winter off season? You know, maybe that's something we can explore the next time we go around, is truly get a measurement post winter. But by the time we started getting measurements, we were like kind of halfway through winter.
Yeah. It would be interesting. I mean, I know injuries are very complex. I know the data, you guys are just getting starting with this like data collection process, but it would be interesting just from like that tendon connective tissue. I'd be curious what, like, on the individual level, what there might be correlations there. Because if you're in the weight, just doing a ton of weightlifting, there wasn't as many on-field contacts, and maybe the tendons weren't as conditioned, it makes me think about, like, you know, if you're more susceptible to an injury mechanism then versus, hey, the tendons are in a good place, you know, and everything. I remember one of the few hamstring strains I've ever had was my junior year of college. I went home for Christmas break and basically just lifted for a few weeks. Like, I didn't really sprint. It was winter in Wisconsin. Like, I'm not going to go out and, you know, 10 and try to get quality speed work. And I was just happy just to lift and do whatever. And then I came back, and then I remember feeling like powerful. Like, I was doing my skips for my warmups and high skips. So like, man, I feel some power. And then I go to do hurdles, and I ran over like one hurdle and pulled like a high hamstring. So it was, it'd be interesting to see. It makes you think almost if like the Achilles could be like a barometer or a bellwether for just the general, hey, this is the general tendon health output connective. I'm probably speculating a lot because I think I hear this. I'm like, oh, yeah. But I'd be curious if there was something there that could.
Yeah, I mean, we did keep track of injuries and that type of stuff. Luckily, we did not have many significant injuries, especially in the population we measured. And I will say the population we measured was not just random guys. You know, it was all voluntary, but it was, you know, a lot of potential NFL guys.
Yeah.
So tried to. So I don't know if that makes the study off or biased, but we tried to select some higher level athletes, guys that are going to play on Sunday. And guys from a muscle driven versus elastic driven, your different body types.
Yeah. With the Achilles correlations, the other thing you'd mentioned was the like correlating to fat-free mass or basically muscle mass or something like that. Any thoughts on why that might have been?
My initial thought is just that the more muscle you have, then the tendon has to respond. You know, when you talk about stiffness is resisting deformation. So I'm thinking your Achilles is probably trying to keep up with the forces used within your muscle. Or is it the other way around?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, and then too, it'd be interesting to think about that. And then just demands, like a Stephon Holm type, they could weigh 75 kilos or, you know, 150 pounds or whatever, that's less than 75 kilos, whatever he weighs, like someone like that, it's just, if there's Achilles thickness, it's just training related. But there's also that piece of whatever you are, if you're a certain weight and strength, the body will adapt, like the tendons. And I think that's the thing, is to think that you could be like, I guess just going and playing like a normal athlete would, and not just sitting in the weight room, but you're out playing, like your tendons have to adapt. Like the body's not dumb. Like the tendons are going to adapt to the force imposed. I'm sure there's work that can be done beyond that, you know, and there is, but on a baseline level, if you have those qualities, there's a level of just basic adaptation that goes with it.
Correct.
Cool. So you mentioned, Ryan, ISA, so infrasternal angle, for people who haven't heard the term before. So could you explain just for if people aren't familiar with infrasternal angle, because I think this is a huge piece in the muscular versus elastic and those changes that go with it. So you recorded it with DEXA, so X-ray, but tell us a little bit about the ISA and how you saw that change and how it may have differed with different infrasternal angle types.
Yeah, so the first time I learned about maybe looking at ISA as an objective measure of whether someone's muscle-driven versus elastic was Dr. Pat Davidson's new book. He talked about doing it. And so, I mean, full disclosure, we tried to do shoulder, hip width, and ISA. The issue being there is that for as advanced as DEXAs are, they're still not really built for our big men. And so, like, you actually, like, have to coach them to kind of scrunch up. So we determined that that's not an accurate measure of shoulder and hip width. So we attempted, and not me, the researchers did. But ISA, you can make an argument that's probably one of the most accurate ways of measuring it is on a deck, because it's an actual X-ray, as opposed to, you know, feeling with your hands and making a measurement off of that. But, you know, kind of what Pat Davidson alludes to is that a narrow infrasternal angle is going to be someone that's more elastic, and typically they have wide shoulders, narrow hips. And then a wide ISA is typically going to be someone wide shoulders, wide hips, and more muscle driven. So we did find some pretty cool correlations with the ISA. On a lot of these athletes, we did a Nordboard ISO 30 test. Which are you familiar with that?
I'm not, no.
So you get the knee bent to a 30 degree angle, and then you push as hard as you can, push your heel up into the strap as hard as you can. And it's like an ISO for like 3 to 5 seconds, overcoming ISO for like 3 to 5 seconds. There is an inverse relationship between ISA. And so what I mean by that is the more narrow, the more force produced in that test. So I'd be interested to ask you, like, do you think that test is more of a muscle driven or elastic fascial tendon driven movement?
Today's podcast is brought to you by Lost Empire Herbs. You can save 15% off of my favorite products with Lost Empire Herbs by heading to LostEmpireHerbs.com/justfly. Use the code Joel15. Lost Empire Herbs is a go-to of mine for supplementation. And looking at the principles, the patterns in nature is such a profound, a powerful observing, a starting point for me in my training. And I've taken that over into supplementation, or my choice of supplementation, as Lost Empire Herbs has harnessed the power of nature, getting things with such minimal processing and such a rich history in Chinese medicine for helping you to improve your vitality, energy, and even strength through their products, things such as Shilajit, the Phoenix formula, and so much more. Head to LostEmpireHerbs.com/justfly today and check out some of my favorite herbs. And there you can get, again, 15% off your order. Yeah, that's a good question. So you said it's at 30 degrees. Explain the setup to me one more time, because I think I know why. And I think it has to do with like more mid stance and early stance access. But what? Tell me like the angles involved one more time.
So like your torso is like laying straight out. Like, okay. They're not like holding. They can brace on the ground.
Yeah.
Get it to where you're at a 30 degree angle of the knee. And then you push your heel up into the strap as far as you can. And then you measure the force on that.
Okay. So it's basically like a Nordic hamstring with the knee joint at a 30 degree angle, and you're straight from knee to shoulder, and you just push. Yeah. So I would say, yeah, chances are like elastics and narrow ISAs are better cyclers. Like when they get in the air and they sprint, from what I've seen, they tend to be people who are a little better at swing leg. I mean, you have wides who are good at this too. Don't get me wrong. But I think it's a little bit easier for a narrow to have good swing leg retraction, where the leg can swing a little bit straighter out in front of them, as well as even acceleration tendencies. I think wides have a much easier time staying like squatted, as a Darian Barr would say, and then the corresponding good like good shin angles, kind of more the bent shin angles and early acceleration. They might stick on those longer because they have more strength there in sports situations. So I think there's, and as I've seen too, and again, like, you know, we were talking about different ISA types. So I was thinking like, you know, LeBron James, you know, breaks the rules. He's wide ISA who can jump off one leg like insanely well, better than two. So you're going to get just, you're going to get different people. But I think by and large, like if you look at like bounding, for example, narrow ISAs are way better at bounding. Maybe that's the easiest one to throw out there. Because if you ask a bunch of wide ISAs to bound, and now you can, and I keep like throwing the exception. I've seen triple jumpers, for example, who I'm almost positive are a wide, but they do it differently. They don't look quite as smooth. There's a different finagling going on. Generally speaking, I think bounding is a thing that narrow ISAs just take up real naturally, which does require a straightening of that swing leg. And so I just think that the way that they, their strength of operation tends to put that hamstring on that longer range stretch load. And also too, maybe it's the calf a little bit work in there. So yeah, I think it's kind of a movement, a movement strengths and tendencies thing. And that's just the beauty of it too, is it's what you do all the time in play that makes those muscles and patterns really strong isometrically. You could influence in the way, I mean, you can, but I think when it comes to some of those serious dynamic patterns or isometric strength patterns, the mass, the biggest impact is your structure and then how you're leveraging your structure every step when you go play and act forcefully. And that's not just a muscle, it's the whole chain of tissue. So that would be my explanation, is that I'm sure there's probably a few other things there, but that would be the best that I could, that would be my first main thought.
No, and I didn't think about it that way. That's why this is awesome. So I think I'm seeing what you're saying, and that like watching high level sprinter, you said in mid stance.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like you watch their like calves, like you watch that video of Usain Bolt sprinting in slow motion. And it's like his calf muscle doesn't like visually, subjectively doesn't move because there's just like so much stiffness.
Yeah.
And now does tendon size equal stiffness? No, not necessarily, but pretending it does, you kind of follow what I'm saying? Like that does kind of make sense then.
Well, there's
that would maybe a more tendon driven movement because of the stiffness required.
Yeah. Like what you said, I was just bouncing off what you said, because I said, you know, it's probably not just one thing, but like you're saying Bull or someone who's so can generate such high level stiffness appropriate to the task. So high velocity sprinting. I mean, that guy's calves are huge. He's got like both soleus and gastroc. Like he's got very, I mean, not like bodybuilder giant, but they're very big and strong. And I'm sure, you know, his hamstrings are well developed too. But if you have a bouncy, like if you run on bounce and that soleus gastroc complex gets built up pretty well, and I think the soleus can get, if you're like a track jumper or high jumper, the soleus maybe even more so, but, and the soleus doesn't plug into the knee, but the gastroc, like if you build that muscle up through a lot of bouncing, it's going to have access to also work the knee joint in flexion. So maybe you also have that. So one, you have access to like more of a swing leg retraction type motion, bounding type motion as an arrow. And then on top of that, you're probably more of a bouncer. So you're using more of your calf anyways. And then that calf, because like I mentioned, like you said yourself, like I'm someone who's very well developed, like calves, you know, glutes are strong, hamstrings, I think they do what they need to do as a biarticular for me, you know, like if I pin my hamstring down in like one of those movements where you put like a foam roller on the ground and I put the ball of my foot on the foam roller in a single leg bridge, my hamstring just gets completely destroyed. Like it has never been a strength of mine. So it's definitely like the whole chain of things. And I think a lot does, like you said, that comes from the calf aspect.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Other things we saw with ISA, it was very strongly correlated with FFMI. And so
Fat free mass.
Fat free mass index. Yeah. Yeah. And so I learned about FFMI because I don't know what you want to call it, but I shared an office with B-Man, Brian Mann, Dr. Brian. And that was one of the things he looked at when we were you know, doing body comp tests is we started looking at fat-free mass index. And so how you calculate fat-free mass index, you really need a DEXA to do it. Sorry, one of the dogs is barking at the vacuum.
Yeah.
So you take lean mass plus bone mineral content, you divide it by height in meter squared. And it's able to, you know, generate a metric. And for reference, you know, it was first established in 1990, really to look at like protein energy malnutrition. Sometimes that's called kwashiorkor, protein deficiency. But what we saw with that is that, yes, it was very strongly correlated with ISA, with FFMI. So the higher the greater the angle, the higher their FFMI is, which in theory makes sense. And that typically that person's going to be wider. So they have the ability to handle more muscle mass on their frame. And then the other, what I think is cool about all these is taking a look at the anomalies within them. So you would think that a big would have the widest ISA on the team. That was not the case. We had a running back actually had the biggest, a 205-pound running back had the biggest ISA. In that upper 25% quartile, there was 3 bigs, 4 skill, and 1 mid. And reference ranges, there's not a whole lot of information out on this, but if you refer to Connor Harris, he has some norms, and anything greater than 110 degrees is technically wide, and then less than 110 degrees is narrow. Our smallest ISA was a 118. Biggest was 149. It didn't really change, not significantly throughout the year. Usually it was like 1 to 2 degrees, if it did.
Yeah, the it is really interesting to look at the like the kind of like what's your maximal or optimal weight for function. Like what weight does your body work really well at? Just because I think without thinking about how, I mean, you could just say too, I think old school 20 years ago, they might have just said, oh, you're just wide boned or you're just big boned. You can carry a lot of muscle mass. But now we can actually go into something that's very statistical and easy. Not necessarily super easy, but something that's measurable and you can list. But it is, I would imagine that, you know, for so long, it's just, hey, you're playing college football, gain some weight, gain muscle, be bigger. And there's this, and some athletes like the wide ISAs, the wider, you know, ribcage folk, sure, cool. Like they can handle that. But then what happens to the narrows is they're asked to be more compressed and gain that muscle mass. And even for myself, you know, as a high jumper, and then even just moving in general, basketball and everything, I mean, and I feel it now, like my best weight at 6'1 or 1 meter 85 is around 175 pounds. Like that's a pretty good weight for me. I move the best, but as soon as I get, I mean, if I get over 190, even if it's like just good muscle, like even if it's a good program, my movement quality does start to suffer. And there's other people who wouldn't, you know, there's other people who certainly wouldn't.
Yeah, I'm not an athlete like you, but my highest vertical jump was when I weighed 175 pounds.
Yeah.
That's lighter than I weigh now and, you know, significantly lighter than I've weighed before. But yeah, I've always jumped better. Kind of like and a lighter body weight, but some people say, "Oh no, if you get stronger and bigger, you'll end up jumping higher." And so, yeah, one of the things you kind of where this leads us to is maybe finding a way to identify optimal body weight.
Yeah, I think up until now, you know, outside of other stats, maybe, you know, a coach who takes a lot of KPIs maybe could figure that out. Like, all right, especially if they're doing like reactive tests and reactive strength and different measurements. And someone, and they were looking at body weight and how, and I think track and field has kind of done this in a way forever, or you know, like most good track athletes, sprinters, jumpers, I mean, obviously not throwers, but they're light. I mean, you know, a lot of those sprinters, like if you're, I mean, you're talking like 6'1", 170, you know, like that kind of build. And you have people who are certainly bigger and successful without question, but jumpers are even less. I mean, it's compared to what you see or what you would expect in most team sports, basketball, football, whatnot. I think soccer, you're a little bit leaner, you know, football, the official name for soccer. You get people who are a little bit leaner, but I think people outside of track don't realize just how light a lot of track athletes are. And I think there's also smaller bone structures, you know, bone structures that are favorable for jumping, you know, longer legs, less of a big, wide, you know, rib cage, things like that. But I think it's athletes who are very in tune with also like, hey, if I get too much weight or muscle, I don't feel, you know, this just didn't feel good. I imagine there's just a lot of that. One, there's talent selection, but there's also that, and it, that just innate feeling. And I know it's interesting too, is the like Eastern European jumpers, like the Soviet Eastern European, like high jump, triple jump, long jump. Those athletes, especially the females, are really, really like lean, skinny. Like they are compared to the rest of the world. I mean, I feel like they're usually, and of course, there's a place where that you can go. There's a danger point in all this, obviously, where you're too light and that causes problems. But it's always seemed to me that those, and they're good too. I mean, really good, but they tend to be like 5 pounds less than the rest of the world, it seems, on average in so many cases. But obviously track being a specialty thing too. It's just interesting to make those correlations.
Yeah. But no, that's why track's a great sport, you know, like Cal Deet says, it's measured by, you know, distinct metric, time or distance or height, and can tell if something's working.
Yeah.
But yeah, do we want to maybe jump into, do you have any other questions on the ISA?
I think, did you measure like changes throughout the year at all? Because the ISA is interesting. I've been told that it like doesn't really change.
Yeah, no, that's what we saw. It didn't really change.
Okay, which is, got it.
Now, with some of these guys, well, some of them are like freshmen. So I plan to continually measure it, and we'll see how it changes. Probably over 4 years might be a better indicator, because you know, Pat Davidson also talks about this concept that if you do a lot of heavy loading, it can potentially widen your ISA. So you know, we'll see, because we do heavy load the guys, but we do a lot of sprinting and change of direction. So if you subscribe to that theory, which no joke, I do, you know, doing good balanced training, a balance of heavy lifting and then sprint, change of direction work and more jumping and ballistic stuff, do you help balance those out? And then I think you can also just make the argument the way the schedule is and the way American football is, I would say a lot of movement and their sport is more elastic in nature. So does that maintain the need to have their narrower angle if they're a quote unquote elastic guy?
Yeah. It is interesting. I mean, I imagine, is there any like correlations that you look in the weight room too, in terms of like lifting, like outputs, different outputs with the different angles or anything like that, like wides,
you know? We did not look at any weight room numbers. Part of that is a product of you know, how long our season went.
Sure.
Are you supposed to try and test guys?
I hear you.
2 months after they play the national championship, or is it more important than the train?
Yeah,
you know, like I was dealing with you know, guys that were recovering from ACs they got in the national championship game. So am I going to test them when their AC hurts so bad they can barely put a bar on their back? But we did look at, and it is full disclosure, it's a small sample size. But of six guys in the study, we did do some force plate stuff. And there's an R value of 0.74 with jump height being explained by FFMI. So to our knowledge, that's the first time FFMI has been looked at in relation to performance.
Just like a standing vertical jump height?
Yeah. It was, yeah, on a force plate.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, of course, there's, as soon as you mentioned Achilles, I instantly think of all these other, you know, what about a four jump or a reactive strength, or what about a 10 meter sprint versus a 40 meter sprint and all these things. But I know there's a lot more to
it. These are the things I think about at 2 o'clock in the morning. We should have measured all this, but
I get you.
I think it's a big deal that we got this thing done.
Yeah, 100%. You know, one thing, I will just ask a few, before I ask a few questions, I think there was something that you were talking about getting to that maybe we hadn't covered yet from the list. Was there something there?
I was going to give some reference ranges for what FFMI numbers look like.
Oh, yeah, perfect.
So, yeah, when you're looking at FFMI, generally speaking, 25 is the highest number you can achieve without using like special sports supplements, but that's more for the general population. From our research and then now and from previously from B-Man's research, that's probably not accurate with football athletes. The highest reported FFMI is a 37 in a sumo wrestler. And then in terms of our study, our biggest was a 32. And if you're looking at like just pure pounds of muscle, don't 100% quote me on this, but that guy that had a 32 as a defensive tackle, and he has like 260 pounds of muscle, just pounds of muscle mass.
That's crazy. Yeah, that's it is interesting to kind of get the like the numbers behind, and like you said, it's probably not you know the exactness, but just to kind of appreciate how much that is. But yeah, you are right, like general population versus like American football, especially like sumo wrestling is an interesting one.
Yeah, and I mean, this kid, he was like he played as a true freshman, started for us at like 17 years old. When I first did a body comp on him, we had bod pod in house. He was like a 30.
Yeah,
that's like a 17. That's crazy. 18 year old. Well, actually, I don't think he would tell me. He's a 17. He's technically like not an adult.
Yeah.
But if you look at the upper quartile of our FFMI, it was five bigs and three mids.
Okay.
And if you were to ask me to describe all those guys, they're all just freaks of nature.
Yeah. Yeah. So would that be, that wouldn't be fat free, or what is it? There's fat free mass. I know in doing like body scans, there's fat mass and fat free mass, which is like muscle, bones, everything. And then actual muscle mass. So that wasn't the fat free, like the non-fat, the 275, that was like,
yeah, it's muscle. Just muscle.
That's crazy.
His numbers are stupid. He's like, because I have all these body pods on all these guys, but Dexa, but he's like a 20% body fat guy. And it's crazy.
Yeah. It makes you think too about, I think even about like metabolic costs too. It's like the flip side of that, where like you have all that muscle mass, but it also requires energy versus, I guess, people who are just lighter, you know, and able to leverage more elasticity. But it's super impressive for sure. I do want to ask just a couple, I guess, maybe like summarizing thoughts and takeaways. Like, just, I know it's a lot of like initial research correlations, things you're seeing. I mean, the Nordic, to me, the one that is so fascinating is Achilles and Nordic, and then the positional. And so just with that in mind, I think something that's like probably super practical, or at least a thought, is, okay, well, if those receivers who didn't have, you know, the Achilles thickness, like, is that a KPI or that could be an issue? You know, Is that something that, hey, let's do some backwards sprints, you know, periodically, maybe we'll time them, or just any thoughts on that for like forward athletes versus backward athletes or training application?
Yeah, that was one of the takeaways. And, you know, I'd give credit to Kyle Bolton, who was on our staff. He was like, you know, it's not all he did, but his wheelhouse on our staff was speed work. He's doing the same thing at the University of Oregon now. And he was the one that just came up with a simple idea. We were seeing that with the receivers, and you know, we only measured two quarterbacks, but their Achilles tendons were pretty small. Which, you know, is that, I know age has a big factor in Achilles tears, but you know, this past year all the talk was
right
with quarterbacks. Which there is an ESPN interview where a surgeon got on and he said that everyone has the same size Achilles tendon, which our study disproved that. But I think like his simple thing is like just doing more backwards work.
Yeah.
You know, for everyone. Because in theory, you know, a bigger Achilles tendon should be able to withstand more of the forces you produce. So just as simple as like if you do something forward, you do it backwards in the womb.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. The best things are often so simple. Like Romain Trullion, I always butcher his last name probably, but the French foot researcher, he talked about how when the toes are in like a more dorsiflexed or upward state, it can load, like you get into like the forefoot. And then obviously like if you're going backwards, you're loading the Achilles. And so it's like backwards running, you know, that you get a lot of things in one natural motion. It just seems, you know, obviously it's not like, it's probably, the thought would be that where I would go is, okay, well, backwards running is one thing, it's good to do it, but there's also in a game you're doing it with like, it's stimulating, it's intense, you're icing, you're reacting, and so it's like you're taking something that's a thing, but the you're layering up the adaptations through demand. So it's like, you know, I guess I think about, that's why I mentioned like, oh yeah, fly 10 backwards, or like, you know, something that's also, you know, has that level of stimulation. But I'm sure just doing the drills backwards is a great place to start. That offers a lot.
It's not like we weren't already doing that stuff. Like yeah. We do, you know, we stride down, we backwards run back in the warm.
Yeah.
You know, we do combo agilities. Like, everyone does the same combo agilities, like sprint, backpedal, shuffle, you know, you change on the whistle. So it's not like we weren't already doing that stuff, but I do think about the same thing as you, like, okay, do more backwards work, but can you replicate all the repetitions a defensive back does backwards? No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think so. And at the intensity. But I mean, it's at least something to think about. So yeah, I think that addresses that point.
Yeah, for sure. I think it'd be interesting too. Like, I mean, like the whole Achilles thing is so multifaceted, you know, like all the tears and stuff. I do think it'd be interesting. I've heard like Carl Valley talking about like players having tendon scans and things like that regularly. I'm sure there's like abnormalities and whatnot, but it would be interesting just as a, like, you know, it's a very general or very global thing. I'd be curious if, you know, those tears that did occur, like what the thickness was, and just as a more global metric, I'm sure.
I'd love to, we couldn't have known what Aaron Rodgers' Achilles tendon looked like, you know, and I mean, maybe it was really thick. Maybe it was too thick.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really thick, then they might have more, what's the word? More chance of having tendinopathies, is some small tears going on in there. You know, that's all the stuff like we don't know.
Yeah. One thing I did, maybe this doesn't 100% correlate to, you know, exactly what we were talking about, but you mentioned it before we pushed record. It was something to the tune of like in a counter movement jump, vertical jump, because this is where Achilles does come into it. But like athletes, like strategies, like jump strategies. I think you said there was like a research study on this with basketball players. But like athletes who will, and I've noticed this, like you have basically vertical jumps where they jump like they squat, kind of the heel stays down more and like the Achilles lengthens a lot more, versus jumpers who drop and like the heel comes up real quick to load like the forefoot. Basically, it's almost like they're trying to put energy in the forefoot. So just thoughts on that. And like, would people who jump and have that heel up strategy, like, hey, I'm going to really get my forefoot loaded up, do you think those people would have like more Achilles tendon thickness that would go with that possibly? Is that like, is that, again, probably a to be studied thing, but I'm just curious because I look at like, what are things you could look at? Just, hey, I'm going to watch how this athlete moves and I can start to gather more information about their overall strategy.
Yeah, I would say subjectively, a lot of our, like, what I would say are elastic skill guys use a shallow hip when they do a vertical jump, shallow hip dip, quick dip. Whereas our more muscle driven guys are the guys that like squat down deeper to kind of access overall low stiffness and really maximize that concentric impulse or output. And all this makes me think of the Black Book of Training Secrets. And when Thibodeau has all of his assessments, one of those is the vertical jump test. And you just subjectively watch the way that they jump and how he originally had it set up. And, you know, he wrote this book,
it was like 20 years ago or something.
20 years ago. And he talked about the shallow dip is more, you know, I don't think he had it in his word, but I think he was saying like type 2X dominant, where the long deep dip is more type 1 dominant. I don't think that is a fiber type test.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I do think it actually is a objective measure of elastic versus muscle driven.
Yeah.
Where 100%. Those the shallow quick dip is probably an elastic guy. The deep dip is muscle driven and someone in between that uses more knee stiffness is a hybrid. And I didn't come up with all that. I've stole all this from Andrew Paul, the head performance coach with the Thunder. But yeah, in those elastic guys with the short dip that's quick, he says that they try to access ankle stiffness.
Yes. Yeah.
For their movement, the hybrid, like I said before, is more knee. And then the muscle driven is low overall stiffness. But it's not just theory, because there's been two studies in basketball players, one in collegiate and one in NBA. And number one, one of the take homes was that vertical jump strategy did not influence actual jumping. So there's different ways to jump and they all still jumped relatively the same heights. But he does have still shots of those guys and those jumps in there, as we described, where, you know, the different ones that we just described, you see that in them. And, you know, what both those studies found is that jump strategy didn't really influence jump height.
Yeah.
But I do believe that there's different things going on. And one of them alluded to it, in that shallow quick dip is probably loading the tendons more. You're utilizing the stretch shortening cycle where, you know, the low overall stiffness getting lower is more like a muscle dominant movement. So yeah, I do think that's a screen for objectively determining if someone's muscle versus elastic driven. And then that made me think of one more thing and I just forgot it.
Now, I have a couple thoughts if maybe it'll help jog your memory too.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so, well, you were saying, I remember back you said that Achilles thickness was also related to fat-free mass. And, well, wide ISAs are capable of more, right? So it actually wouldn't be something that would cater more towards narrows or wides in that sense with the Achilles. And I was thinking about, you know, the maybe a wide ISA who might do a vertical in a much more like deep knee bend. Heel stays on the ground longer. They're using more of their muscles. And with that, actually, I will say it was, I think Sparta Science had said something, because they did all sorts of jump testing stuff and trying to extrapolate it to different things. But they had actually said that people who dig deep in the jump have more fast twitch muscle, at least probably in the quad extensors, which would make sense because it's like, well, what's your superpower? Hey, I got a lot of fast twitch muscle. Okay, well, go down deep and use that fast twitch muscle, you know, where if you don't have it, or as much of it, or maybe in those areas, then, well, I'm going to use elasticity. I'm going to like load my foot and ankle and then lever the whip of my torso off of it through my hips. Like that's how I've jumped for a very long time, and a little bit less so. I became more of a hybrid over time through a lot more lifting. But yeah, I was just thinking maybe it isn't, you know, maybe people's Achilles, maybe the thickness would be the same, but for a, someone who digs deep and has a lot of ankle dorsiflexion, that Achilles is still long and it has to be loaded and it has to work. Like it can't not be working because, you know what I'm saying? Like, so I was just thinking maybe there's just more to it with the Achilles and strategy than just that. You know, if fat-free mass does correlate heavily in there.
Correct. And it does. And it makes me think about super training where they say that, you know, ground contact time. I know a vertical jump isn't like a hurdle hop or depth drop, but I'm hypothesizing that because I always question that 0.25 or less.
Yeah.
Has to be when the stretch shortening cycle takes place. And I'm like, well, you're still hitting the ground and jumping back up. Like some level of it has to be happening, but this would kind of cater to that thought that that shallow dip is like a short ground contact time.
Yeah.
And so, and I think from force plate data, you're seeing that it's more eccentric bias. So you would think that it's more of a stretch shortening cycle, more loading the whole muscle tendon movement, where spending longer on your descent, getting deeper is more, you know, loading the muscles. So that 0.25 makes more sense to me. Now, is it 0.25 or 0.2?
I think 0.25 is the official cutoff. I'll have to pull out super training here real quick. We'll thumb through it in the middle of the podcast and figure it out. I think it's 0.25.
I got it right here.
Yeah, I was going to say too, with the, you know, what you're saying with the jump, like it definitely is something where maybe in that context of vertical jump where, like, yes, the Achilles is getting used if it's a long jump. I don't want to like get too far down this rabbit hole, but even if you didn't use the Achilles in that, you're going to do, when you go out and play, you're doing all sorts of jabs and cuts and little sprint steps that are short contact on a single leg repeatedly and in much higher volume than, hey, let's go do 3 sets of 5 depth jumps or something in the weight room. So it's like, it makes sense that, you know, even outside of a vertical jump strategy, the Achilles of a wide ISA has plenty of chances to adapt to fast contacts and a variety of movements. And it's just when a narrow has a certain movement they're tasked with, okay, well, this is the strategy that works for me. I'm going to do it this way.
Right. And the other thing that makes me think of, and even more so with these research studies, because, you know, a lot of credit to Andrew Paul, because number one, when you talked about in your book, Speed Shrink, that was the first time I heard about elastic fascial driven versus muscle driven. But then Andrew Paul has, you know, a system to classify his athletes and where they fall in that spectrum. And I thought that football, until this study, generally speaking, I thought the positions of football filtered you. So muscle driven guys are interior, linemen, mids or hybrids. The further you get away from the ball, the more elastic you have to be. But after this study, and I can come back to one of the craziest anomalies and a correlation I think we're onto that we just discovered yesterday, is that no, that's not necessarily true, because he has like two different centers that fall on complete opposite ends of the spectrum. I think that now with the results of this study, it is the same as basketball. It dictates how you play your position. not what position you play.
Yeah.
Did I explain that clearly?
Yes. Yeah. So for like football, I think that would be interesting in that, like, let's say, I mean, usually the weight room is divided up skills, you know, bigs and mids in many cases, but it's like, it would just be assumed that all the bigs are the same body type and response type, you know, but they might not be, you know, I mean, maybe there's more, what's the term, like homogenicity, like more similar than, maybe there's more similarities in the bigs than there, you know, maybe there's more wides in the bigs than the skill, but I don't know, like, but it makes sense that based off what you were talking about, like, hey, your wide SA, your max fat-free mass is higher, maybe we can push that more for you versus, hey, this, maybe we have a narrow ISA who's a, you know, a lineman or whatnot. And it, well, it makes me think too, like almost what's your, it does make me think a little bit about, you know, if you're like developmental and you're a certain structure, well, should you be a linebacker or a line? I don't know. Like it is interesting to think about that based on maximal, what's the maximal muscle fat-free mass that your body's going to work well with at some point and might that dictate where you end up. So it's interesting things to think about.
And I'll reiterate that that upper 25% quartile for ISA was 4 skill, 1 mid, and 3 big. So that lends itself to this theory more. And so it sent us down a rabbit hole with Caleb, one of the researchers, and me was, we're talking about this running back we have that has the biggest ISA on the team. And I think about the way he moves. And do you know the running back for the Chiefs, Isaiah Pacheco?
I don't think so.
Yeah, look up some videos of him running. He runs, I mean, he's fast. I think he ran like 4.3 at the combine in the 4.3s. But he runs so violent and hard.
Hmm.
And I think about a running back that does that.
Yeah.
And then I think back to our Stat Sports GPS reports, and we ran, just picked a random practice during spring ball and took a look. And we ended up dropping the bigs because the positional demands kind of filter out them doing this. But one of the measurements we do, high metabolic load efforts. And so by definition, how we have it classified is that's like really hard A cells or D cells. So like greater than 3 meters per second for acceleration or negative 3 meters per second on a D cell. And like, you know, explosive movements off the line. And so we ran a quick correlation, and I think that we're onto something with that.
Yeah,
because the wider ISA guys generally have more high metabolic load efforts at practice. And we're gonna do a deep dive into this. Cool. Which what I love about this so much is that there is a subjective component.
Yeah,
and the one thing I didn't mention was part of my motivation with this is I was like 3 years ago, I commented on one of your posts when you're talking about straight up, straight down jumping or the, what do you call
rotation,
this thing?
Yeah, rotational. Oh, like kind of a winging, like, what's the, I guess spiraling, winging of the arms, like in a, like more of a, instead of straight front to back, it's like a circular, you know, or spiraling action of the arms. Corkscrew. There's different. There's
you
different
had emotions. A video of guys jumping different ways, and I commented and I said, is this, because ever since I've been, you know, read about that concept, like I told you before we started recording, in my copy of Speed Strength, I have notes next to it, like every time, how do you measure this? How do you objectively measure this? And I just asked you, do you think just a vertical jump test is a good way, and just how are they naturally use their arms? You know, I would think straight up, straight down, muscle driven, rotational, elastic. And I asked that question to you, and Lance Brooks responded, and you know, he said that there's no such thing as muscle driven versus elastic, and everything's force driven, all that. We actually happened to work on this same campus because I was at SMU at the time and he was working in the speed lab there. I wanted to link up with him and get his perspective. Because, I mean, he is the researcher, not me, but I want to try and explain subjectively what I see. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we were never able to link up. But I've since spoke to him about it, and I thanked him because in a lot of ways he was right, because I have no objective measures. It's just subjective in terms of watching an athlete move. But to tie all that back to this HML efforts, what you see with people that have high HML efforts, and we ran, like I said, like two practice correlations, and we did see wider ISA, more HML efforts. And I say all that to say, like, if you watch a guy that has a lot of HML efforts, the first thing you'll notice, I think you'll see, is they run hard.
Yeah, high metabolic load, by the way, right? HML.
High metabolic load efforts. And they run hard, and there's less overall stiffness. So when they're decelerating, they're dropping their center of gravity more. I brought this up to Coach Kaz, and he said, does that have something to do with them having the wider angle, higher muscle mass? Because I've never worked with someone that can look at athletic movement the way he did. And he played the linebacker at the highest level. But what I'm getting to is, like, you see them bend more. Whereas our most narrow ISA, subjectively, he is way more quick out of his cuts and, like, plays higher, you know, and a lot of football coaches are going to tell him to play lower.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I think that we're onto something with that, you know, and he talked about that narrow guy has so much less muscle mass, he doesn't need to drop down.
Yeah.
Whereas the wider guy has more mass, so he has more mass to control, and you access that through low overall stiffness in your movement. So I don't know. I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. Like, kind of with the fast twitch muscle, or even just if you have a lot of powerful muscle, you need to load that muscle versus the, like Pat Davidson, you referenced, has mentioned, there's the athlete who's more air and more ground. And if you're more air, it's just more of loading the spring-like nature of the tissue. And there's only so far you need to drop down to optimally load. And I think a lot of it too is, even beyond the ankle, I think optimally loading even the forefoot, like if we go into different parts of the foot, loading the forefoot with energy that radiates out. I think there's something with that, to with the heel off the ground and some of those higher positions, that if you look at a leverage perspective, like to keep the heel off the ground to load the forefoot, versus as soon as the heel goes down, now I can load my muscles more. So I think there's a lot of complexity to it, but I am definitely the, hey, I love the subjective and I'll hang out here. And then, yes, I get people like you and can show some objective measures behind my subjective, you know, mechanical observations. But I love seeing the numbers behind it. I think it is really important, because until there is an objective, it is just subjective, you know, and I think it is the subjective that drives the research and investigation into, hey, there's a number behind this. There's something we're seeing here. But at the same time, like you said too, with like those players who play high, is it really just one thing? You know, like there might be a lot of things. It's a complex situation too. Might be a few things at play.
Man, I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that I'm biased.
Yeah.
Because I do believe it's a thing, from watching football players move since 2008. I do think there's something to it. And I do think there's something to training interventions to, you know, maximize the way that they move. And one other big takeaway is, I do think that there's a nutrition piece.
Yeah.
Supplementation piece and all this. And, you know, my original motivation was Keith Barr and isometrics and collagen. And so looking at isometric work first, which we do a lot of. Now, we don't do 5-minute holds, but we'll do some holds up to 90 seconds. So, I mean, I don't know how you do a 5 minute hold.
That, like, it's not fun. I'll tell you that.
The longest I've ever gone is like 2 minutes and 15 seconds. But like just in the timing, you know, time is a limitation in NCAA.
Right? Yeah, and like efficiency, like how much more am I getting out of this 3rd minute, this 4th minute, this, you know, 5th minute? Not to mention how many kids can actually tolerate that. It's not a high percentage. And it took me a long time to get up there. So I get it.
Yeah. And so I believe that the isometrics work for different reasons for elastic versus muscle driven. So I think a muscle driven guy could potentially derive more performance benefit. Cause you're, you know, if you do it right, you squeeze the muscles, stress, relaxation, load gets distributed, through the tendon. But I think that you're potentially improving the total muscle tendon unit there. And so you might be able to get some elastic qualities out of that where they're more biased to be more muscle driven. And then I think it's potentially more of an injury prevention work for the elastic athletes because subjectively, those are the guys that deal with a lot more jumpers than the tendonitis. And we know, and we don't 100% know why. I know Keith Barr has his ideas, but whether it's Keith Barr or Joe Cook, they both agree that ISOs work for tendinopathy pain relief.
Yeah.
And so with those elastic guy holding it, I think that you're distributing force through that disorganized part of the tendon that's causing the tendinopathy. And so you're loading it. So it's in some way, I think it's promoting the healing of that tissue or reorganization of that structure. And then you take that a step further and you look at collagen protein. And so my takeaway there is that, you know, especially with the data that we see with 180-pound DB having Achilles tendons as big as offense and defensive linemen, that they probably use their tendons to move more, whereas the muscle-driven guy uses his muscle to move more. And so if I'm using my tendons to move more, I should definitely be supplementing with collagen.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the research is getting better. I know we have research now on knee extension and calf raise and collagen supplementation outperformed for cross-sectional area, the tendon size. So we know it's probably helping make those tendons bigger. And if it's a tendinopathy, you know, theoretically, it's healing that tissue. So should they have more collagen than the normal athlete? I think maybe. But then you look at the big men, and you're trying to get them to have a little bit more elastic qualities. You give them collagen, you give them materials to build that up before you train. So long story short, I think that everyone should supplement with collagen. I think it's, you know, and Keith Barr has seen performance increase with supplementing with collagen and jump performance and college athletes. So I think that they both work with collagen and ISOs, but maybe for different reasons. But collagen as a supplement is way too cheap, and that benefit is potentially way too high. To not supplement with it. Like, I know that it's not 100% definitive. Now, we do have research showing it did. Because my big question with Keith Barr's research is he always said he found conclusively collagen supplementation increases collagen synthesis. But when you look at research, we know synthesis doesn't necessarily, like, that's a cool mechanism, but does it lead to a measurable change? You can supplement with protein and it increases protein synthesis, but it doesn't always equal hypertrophy, right? So that was like the rabbit hole I first went down with the collagen and isometrics is, what exactly is this synthesis leading to? because when I did my bro research project, initially there really wasn't any research that showed what that synthesis led to. And I think I and a lot of people assume when they read his research that that synthesis equals cross-sectional area increase. And initially, in my opinion, unless I misread his papers, it never measured actual tendon size. So. Yeah. Thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know. There might be something in the quality there. You know, I guess it has to be like the quality of the tendon, something that might go, you know, beyond that. I mean, I'm not an expert on the micro level of tendon at all, but you think maybe there's like a density alignment, like just quality of the tissues. I mean, it clearly, if the research showed that it improved these outputs, which I believe for collagen and college athletes, then something beneficial is happening. And I think for the most people, you know, you don't need to go further than that. I think it's so interesting to think just, it is like a paradigm shift in the sense. And, you know, I think that the industry has been talking about muscular and elastic for a little while now. But yet we haven't got that point where it's still all just protein. Oh, you're done with your workout. Just have your protein shake and your carbs are in there, right? Like to, you know, get the insulin spike, but no one's like, hey, we got to feel those tendons up and the collagen. That has not seen, I think, even close to. Now with the tendon stuff coming out and Keith Barr, yes, a little bit more, but that makes all the sense in the world to me. I mean, I've really enjoyed supplementing with collagen recently, and I think it's awesome. I would definitely be on that same.
I mean, anecdotally, I mean, I guess that's another disclaimer with our study is that like, well, number one, myself and Coach Kaz do a lot of nutrition education, like almost every single day post-training. For like the first 2 weeks, and then I back off and he does a lot more sports psychology work. But our guys use collagen heavy. We do the shot pouches, but then we also get the powder and we put it in their smoothies and shakes. So that could be a disclaimer with the study with changes we saw in tendon size.
It's being supplemented with as well. Yeah. But hey, it's still interesting to think about. No doubt it's beneficial. And it makes sense too, just more like back to what you said. It just makes sense. Like people are playing on the field more, not lift, before his weights, then they're playing dynamic, seeing more growth. Like it makes sense. Even if there's those little caveats, a lot of what you're saying just also makes fundamental sense.
But the point I forgot about to say this. Anecdotally, I have a lot of athletes that I've coached here at TCU that are 100% sold on collagen. They say when they stop using it, that's when their tendonitis flares up. But if they consistently use it, it subsides.
Yeah.
So I think there's something to it. And the researchers did originally want to do a collagen intervention. And I said, well, you're not going to get away with that because I already told them all that no questions asked, they should be taking it.
Yeah.
So I wasn't going to, go back. And like I said before, it's too cheap and benefits too high for us to be giving guys a placebo collagen. So I told them, we're not doing that. Like we already supplement with collagen and we're not going to play some voodoo magic and give them a placebo.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, hey, I think that's about the end of the time that we have for today. And I mean, this stuff's fascinating, Ryan. I'm really stoked that you had messaged me about what you were finding and, with the tendons, Achilles, all the correlations. It gives me so much to think about and consider. And I'm sure it's been really helpful as well for everyone else who's been listening. So where can people, if people want to learn more about what you guys are up to, or if there's like other or something new on the horizon, like what the next steps for you are with all this, any closing thoughts there before we.
I'd love to hear people reach out. My Instagram is RyanJackson46 because our IRB is approved to continue this. So before we leave, Joel, I would like from your perspective and anyone reach out and let me know maybe more some performance metrics. We started messing around with the like force plate mid thigh pulse. So I think we're going to start running correlations on that. We got some more vertical jump data we can start running correlations on. I think we're going to take a deep dive, and this might end up just being another study because Caleb's about to graduate and this is his dissertation. So he's got to get this thing published at some point. But I think we might do a follow-up study with all the stat sports GPS data. So miles per hour, you know, high speed running, see if there's any correlations there. But if anyone has any other ideas, and I'd love to hear your ideas right now of what else you would want to see measured, and we'll try to make it work.
Yeah. I mean, if you're putting me on the spot, I mean, I like the different segments of a sprint, you know, but again, there's a lot of confounding variables, but like reactive strength and fore jump, like versus standing vertical, I think those basic things, but it would be interesting to see. I think in a sprint, depending on, again, the confounding variables and how you measure it, but like 0 to 5, 5 to 10, 10 to 20, and what are you seeing throughout those segments that can paint, if you talk about painting a picture, I think that paints a really interesting picture. So, you know, hopefully that gives you something to chew on with that. And I'm excited to see how it all turns out for you. And yeah, definitely keep me updated.
Yeah. And then other contact info would be, we have a TCU football, like human performance Instagram. It's just TCU football_human performance. And then my email is ryan.jackson@tcu.edu. And then I'll send over, once we get done, my bro research project. But like I said, that was like 5 years ago. So more research has come out. My thoughts have evolved, but it does a pretty good job of breaking down how tendons adapt and ties in the collagen and isometric piece.
Yeah, I love it. Oh, single leg RSI would be good too, that Rich Burnett talked about.
Single leg RSI.
Yeah, that'd be the jam. The simplest thing, you know, versus standing vert. So anyways, thank you so much. It was wonderful having the chat here, Ryan. Appreciate your time.
No, I appreciate being on.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode. I appreciate you being here. And if you enjoy the show, you can leave it a rating or review on Spotify, iTunes, whatever you are listening to on. I would definitely appreciate that. And I'll see you next week.